So hey everybody, welcome to Voices from the Frontlines. This is Eric Mann, your host. The first comrade on the show today is Sun Young Yang. As I said, she's an organizer with the Labor Community Strategy Center, the lead organizer with the Bus Riders Union, and one of the initiators of our soon-to-be-famous No Cars, No Way campaign. Hi, Sun. How you doing?
How are you?
I'm good. So we'll talk about recipes later, but to start, you just came back from Korea. Tell our listeners about your own relationship to Korea in the past, the present, and some of your thoughts about your future trajectory.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's first my homeland, where I was born, so I have a very special connection to it, even though I didn't grow up there technically. It was not until 2006 when I returned, and actually getting really through the Korean Education and Exposure Program, which is a two-week program that Nodutol, some KA organizations inside the United States, take second-generation or Korean-Americans to Korea to meet with social movement forces and learn about the Korean left and the history. And so it was not until 2006 when I participated in that program that I really get to learn about my own history and the actual current-day struggles that are still happening. And there's a really vibrant left social movement inside Korea. I think that's both militant and disciplined and pretty inspiring. And so every year since then, I've been able to, you know, a couple of years, go back and visit and reconnect. And this year, too, I was able to participate in a week-long food sovereignty tour inside South Korea.
Well, the concept of food sovereignty, how do you define it? What is it? What's the political edge to it?
I mean, there's many definitions, but it actually, the concept first came out in 1994, I believe, when La Via Campesina, the Worldwide Federation of Peasants, small farmers and peasants, gathered together to talk about how the, you know, global, basically neoliberal economy, how capitalism was destroying the masses, billions of people's ability to grow their own food and live off of their land because of all the land grabbing and free trade markets were destroying people's ability to do that. And so the concept of food sovereignty is not just about, different from food security, where food security talks about you accessing and securing food for a given population or a given people. Food sovereignty actually talks about the whole process, not only of securing food, but through the process of making sure that everybody is able to eat, also the farmers, the people that produce the food, and an entire nation is able to do it in a just and democratic way without starving the very people that are feeding us, which is what's happening in the current economic world order, is that the very people that are growing the food and feeding us at the end of their harvest can't even pay the money that they used invested to grow the food for us. So farmers all over the world are starving, and the concept of food sovereignty is really trying to uplift the self-determination of farmers, which are the vast majority of the population inside the world, as ability to have a dignified life and continue this tradition of growing food for the people. And I think it's a very powerful concept, because in the root of it all, when corporations and capitalism tries to control seeds and people's ability to grow food, that's sometimes more powerful than going and invading a country with guns and military arms, right, when you take away and control their food access. And so food sovereignty is a global movement that's trying to take food and our ability to sustain ourselves back away from corporations and back into the hands of the people.
Well, you know, Arundhati Roy has been doing some important writing about both peasants and farmers in India just committing suicide in mass numbers because of what you described. But on the other hand, the rise of Maoist armed struggle, which she has taken a great risk to basically at least support in the general anti-imperialist tradition, to say, you tell me between suicide and armed struggle, what would you pick? How much do you think the food sovereignty movement has a strong anti-imperialist edge, and in particular an anti-U.S. edge? Does it? And how are the kind of politics of this playing themselves out?
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a really fascinating question, because my own personal politicization moment came from the whole fight in Latin America when I saw indigenous peasants, right, rise up in Latin America, especially in Ecuador and Peru, opposing the free trade of the Americas. And every farmer and indigenous person that I talked to who were protesting out there knew that the whole neoliberal economic model and all that that was being handed down by the IMF and the WTO and all that was created inside the United States. And so essentially there was a lot of, you know, there's understanding that U.S. imperialism, both U.S. government and the market forces were playing the biggest hand in land grabbing and taking farmers all over the world their ability to sustain themselves. So I think some of the most militant and anti-imperialist like mass gatherings have been led by La Vía Campesina. I remember in, you know, 2010 in Cancun, when I was there as a Strategy Center's representative and with Grassroots Global Justice Alliance, we were there at the UN Climate Conference in 2010 in Cancun. The biggest social movement mobilization was led by La Vía Campesina, and talking about connecting the issue around climate change and food sovereignty and farmers, and why climate change was a big threat. And within that, the United States that year was playing a role in sabotaging the negotiations, as usual. So farmers there were very cognizant of what was happening. And I think you can't really separate food sovereignty with anti-U.S. imperialism because, you know, who's going around the world right now negotiating the deals? You know, the Obama administration right now is negotiating the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And, for example, South Korea is not a member to it, but is trying to get access to becoming a member, where the United States, a lot of the Western countries, can then trade with across the Pacific with Asian nations. And it's going to have another wave of destruction for Korean farmers. And so the Korean farmers very well know that, you know, Obama has been in the middle of all this negotiation, making sure that U.S. agro industries and corporations are going to be benefiting from this process, and that these kinds of free trade agreements are being promoted most strongly by United States. So I think it's not just an alternative movement, but it has a very militant anti-imperialist, anti-capitalist tendency as well.
Well, after spending almost 10 years with us as just a very, very gifted organizer, you're going on a new journey. You're still politically part of the Strategy Center, but you're going to be geographically opening up some of our international struggles. Tell us a little about your own journey. What are you going through? What you're thinking about the next 2 years of your life? What are you trying to figure out?
I think the work that I've been doing for the last 10 years as an organizer inside the Strategy Center has given me pretty amazing growth around how do you first, as an individual, as a politically conscious being, try to orient yourself in the world and how to be useful, right? And a very humbling process as well, giving perspective around the very important task of fighting inside the United States and what it means to work towards weakening the empire, right? So that different social movements within the United States as well as outside of the borders of the United States have a chance to build their alternative, right? Alternatives to capitalism. And I think what I realize is that one of the places that I want to further develop is understanding better about issue about land struggles, and how do we create complete systems, given that the ecological crisis is going to be, if not one of the biggest contradictions that's going to be facing humanity, how are we reconnecting back to more sustainable ways of living, and what is that going to look like, especially for us to adapt to climate change, for us as social movements to be able to lead that piece as well, being read an expert on it. And so I'm hoping to maybe go around the world and learn some of those basic skills like agroecological farming, as well as how does energy systems work, and also learn from the peasants, which I think are fundamentally right now at this moment have both the mass nature and militancy to take on global capital. And so it's going to be a pretty exciting, both physically, I think, right. Doing farm work is not easy, and emotionally, and a lot of growth, hopefully, that I can learn all those things and bring it back to the movement here. We're every day we're trying to create new vision, give hope to the masses here too. And the Strategy Center right now is talking about the fight for the soul of the cities, where we're trying to promote the environmental justice state and fighting the police state. And all the while, we're envisioning LA with no cars, 5,000 zero emission buses. And another element that I hope I can come back and bring to is around the issue around food sovereignty, which, as Marx had said, there is a fundamental disconnect that capitalism and modern industry has brought to society, where we've been completely disconnected from our ability to cultivate the soil and sustain ourselves ecologically.
Right.
So I think I want to, you know, learn from the international peasant movement or around that fundamental contradiction, and hopefully I can bring it back and help expanding our fight for the soul of the cities, both on a theoretical and practical level.
Well, that's very exciting. It really is, Sun Yung. It's very, you're listening to the voice of Sun Yung Yang, a lead organizer at the Labor Community Strategy Center. Going to go on at least a 2-year journey. I believe it's going to involve Cuba as well as Korea, and we'll talk more about that in a minute. You know, Sun, one of the things I was thinking about is, as you were talking, is traditional Marxism, which did come out of a European worldview. If you read the Communist Manifesto, it's very dismissive of the peasantry. It argues that the peasantry is backward and that the proletariat is the new class, and the peasantry is, even at one point, talks about a reactionary class. Mm-hmm. And obviously, as Marxism moved into an international context and was picked up more revolutionarily by the Russians and the Chinese and the Vietnamese, they said, wait, you know, we're taking the basic analysis, but we're moving more from Lenin's theory of imperialism, mm-hmm. and in which the contradiction is, you know, between the oppressor and the oppressed nations. So then you have, did you ever read Mao's investigation into the peasant movement in Hunan?
Yes.
That's one of my favorite.
Well, it was a mandatory reading by y'all.
by me and Leanne? Good.
Well, it's under the great guidance of Leanne Hirschman. Yes.
Good. Well, that's great, because one of the things that we love about that book, I'll just say a couple of things and you could respond, is that Mao is great, obviously, and one of the things is his sense of humor is, you know, he's talking to all these urban intellectuals. He said, well, what you're discussing, whether the peasantry is revolutionary or reactionary, they're having a revolution without you, and they don't seem to need your leadership. And he goes out and he does this investigation, in which he said, there are this many large peasants, there are this many middle peasants, there are this many small peasants, there are this many peasant associations, down to like numbers, minute numbers of what he understands. And obviously, he argued that the peasantry could actually be the main force of a third world revolution. So for you going sort of back to the peasantry, it's interesting that that is still a mass question in the world, right? I mean, that's one of the things that I don't think people in the United States think enough about or have enough consciousness about.
Yeah, who are the masses of people that fought in the Viet Cong army?
That's right.
You know, there wasn't a large industrial base in Vietnam when the Vietnam War broke out, right? This was one of the things that I learned when I went back to Korea this time on the food sovereignty tour. Was in 1894, there was a whole Tongak peasant rebellion where the peasants rebelled against the king, the Chosun king, who was basically pretty much weakening, and both China, the United States, and Japan were getting ready, duking it out to try to colonize Korea. And amidst all that, the only forces that basically rose up was the Korean peasants, who were basically getting overtaxed as the king was trying to satisfy the elites and the foreign forces that were pressuring him. And so that rebellion, unfortunately, got squashed as the Korean elite brought in Japanese soldiers and Chinese soldiers to crush.
What year is this?
The 1894
peasant
rebellion. But the peasants, the Tongak philosophy, which is Eastern learning, was all about, and this was, you know, during a feudal period, right?
Right.
For the first time in Korea's history, said that all people are equal. And the Tongak peasant leaders signed a bow agreement in which they wrote their name in a circle, so both to, because there was no spacing, you couldn't tell, like, who was what.
Right.
So it was both, you know, strategic in terms of trying to cover their name, but at the same time, because everybody's equal, so we shouldn't, you know, they shouldn't sign it vertically. And that what I learned was that women peasants were also involved in it, right? And so in Korea, where there was a pretty strong, almost caste system, for the first time in history, peasants, you know, rose up under Dongak's philosophy of that all people are equal, and they fought with bamboo spears against basically invaders with metal, like, what is it, metal guns and weapons, and they got crushed. But I think the spirit of the peasant rebellion, I think, continued to fuel a lot, both some of the most fierce fights and resistance during Japanese colonization. And then post that, a lot of the communist forces that were organizing and getting ready for Korea to become an independent state when they would get free from Japanese colonization, those forces were also, a lot of them came out of like the peasant base. And so if you look even at throughout Korea's history, the most fierce resistance to both U.S. imperialism, right, because subsequently United States came and crushed any kind of movement that happened post-World War II. And so if you look at all that, the most central forces that were involved in that were rural peasant people in Jeju Island currently too. Some of the most fierce struggles against U.S. military base expansion and just any kind of militarization activity is farmers fighting against land grabs, and both by the military and development. And, you know, and definitely in Korea's history case, the, you know, kind of the revolutionary forces has been proven to be peasant leaders, at least consistently throughout history. I know in the 1980s and the 1960s and 70s, because Korea had rapid industrialization, the workers also, and the workers and students were very pivotal to the Korea democratization movement. But if you look at, like, throughout the history consistently, who has participated, it has been the peasantry. And so I think in Marx's case, applying it to third world nations, I think he was definitely did not assess them.
Right. Well, this is great. Again, you're listening to Sun Young Yang. This is Eric Mann, your host on Voices from the Frontlines. And, you know, Sun, one of the things just listening to you talk is, and this is part of the conversations we've been having a lot at the Strategy Center lately, is to, when we build the more anti-imperialist edge to our own work, it really comes to life more. You know, the more we talk about history, number one, and then internationalism, number two, it makes the work in the United States feel more important in some way. We're not just taking on our own government, but we're taking on the government that people all over the world are asking us to take on. Mm-hmm. And we're not taking them on simply because we want better bus fares, or even that we don't want the police to beat us in the schools, but we're trying to educate people that this is part of a world struggle for liberation. And I have to say, I'm a little encouraged. You know, I have my up and down days, but I think the work we're doing in the high schools, the new discussions we're having with our members, just for a minute, Sun and I and Rosie Miranda, Eric Roman, Barbara Lott Holland, we're doing a lot of work with what we call the Speakers Bureau, which is sometimes as many as 30 and 35 and 40 Black and Latino, primarily working class people of different ages, from, I don't know, 16 to, we have to almost 100, and trying to educate ourselves more historically about what's going on. And what I'm very excited about your project is, I just think the more internationalism we bring back, which was the key to the 60s, you know, the key was that we saw ourselves as a world revolution against imperialism. I think that's been lost a lot, and I think it's even been lost in our own organizing work. And I think we're all trying to have sort of a revolution of our own consciousness, because I saw the way how upset and angry you were about telling that story in 1894. It is still both heartbreaking and inspiring.
Yes, I mean, I think one of the greatest thing that the Strategy Center does, I think, is really try to root younger up-and-coming organizers and folks in history. I think a lot of times, sometimes people think some of the tactics that we come up with is something completely original that we're doing for the first time, but you know, right. It's precisely put out because, you know, our mentors, you, different folks, are avid readers and learners of history. And I think it's very grounding for me and comforting for me, A, to think that there is a world majority of struggling people who that we're a part of versus feeling very isolated within the United States, right? If we say we're just a movement. And two, connecting with the history and the real lessons that we can learn from, you know, everything from, you know, the freedom vote that helped us launch the voting rights referendum for Trayvon Martin this summer,
right,
to, you know, the Speaker's Bureau, the concept of the Speaker's Bureau, which comes, you know, out of the civil rights movement. And I think a lot of the tactical things and strategic conversations that we have come rooted from history, and I think it just makes us reaffirm that we have to teach history. And one of the things we constantly talk about is how sad it is right now and currently inside the United States, where entire generations are suffering from menticide, what Mumia Abu-Jamal calls menticide, where our own generation doesn't get to learn about the vast history of struggle that we have and be able to ground themselves in it and fight. And so I think the Strategy Center's way of teaching and cultivating organizer is to root them in history and then put that in, try experimenting it, you know, putting that in practice. And I think that's one of the valuable things that I walk with post working at the Strategy Center for 10 years.
Well, to end, Sun, we're going to have you on again before you go, and then we'll probably have you on as you travel over the world. But this morning, somehow at 6 in the morning, I'm doing an interview with this very good guy from Germany. And as a Jew, trust me, there are very few times I say a very good guy from Germany. But a really fine person who has worked actually with the Strategy Center. I work with Causa Justa in Oakland. So he was asking me, he said, your sense of history, like, obviously I know there was the 60s, and I think there were these workers' councils in the 30s. What other historical events have shaped you? I said, well, from the caveman, when they started having primitive communism, we're in a tradition that since class society was established, from the first time there was a class society, there was a class struggle. And I'm trying to learn the whole history of indigenous people who came here all the way back. And we're just a little window in our life, part of a long continuum of amazing people who have struggled. And all we have to do is devote our life to it. That's all we have to do. And then we'll bring another generation in. And I'm really, as always, proud to work with you, Sun Yung Yang. And thanks for being on the show, and we'll have you back again.
Okay, well, I will look forward to it.
Take good care of yourself.
You too. You too. Okay.